Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm picking up where I left off a couple of weeks ago, talking about your undercover. Those qualities which, for some very good reason, you had to hide, even from yourself. And I'm playing an interview I'm doing with the remarkable Eva Slain, whose story begins with an escape from the Holocaust and goes on to be dedicated to the theater in every possible way that a person can be dedicated to the theater. Looking back at an 80-year-old life, Eva's story is remarkable, and I know that you will benefit from hearing it. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about becoming who you really are. Who you really are. Aren't you who you really are? Well, of course. You can't be other than you are. So you must be being who you really are. So what do I mean by becoming who you really are? Well, as a psychotherapist who's been in private practice for over 30 years, I have seen over and over again that people are in denial for parts of themselves, important parts of themselves. That because we learn early in our lifetime that some of our qualities, some of our natural ways of being, some of our talents really, some of our skills, some of the things that are basically true of us could get us in trouble in our families or in school or with our friends, we learn to pretend that that isn't so. We hide that quality. First we hide it from others, and then we hide it from ourselves. That's what denial is. It's the gift of our unconscious. It helps us pretend that in some important ways we are not who we really are. Well, so what? Well, the so what is that while this may have worked when you were a kid to make your parents or your grandparents or your friends or your teachers more comfortable or happy or like you, when you get older, the quality that you hid may very well be a quality that you need in order to live the best life that is possible for you. So, quite often I see in my practice that people want to be or need to be some things that they already are. They just don't know it. I call the qualities that we believe about ourselves, that we lead with that we find acceptable, our cover story. And those qualities which we have had to hide, I call them our undercover. You can find clues to the identity of your cover story simply listening to the way you talk to or think about yourself. Maybe you don't realize that you can always tap into a constant stream of inner dialogue. We all have an ongoing running commentary in our heads of ourselves, by ourselves, for ourselves, to ourselves. And listening for recurring themes, phrases, watchwords can give you a clue to what you think about yourself, what your cover story is. Listen, especially to your favorite cliches about yourself. Do you often think of yourself as caught in the middle, or a lucky SOB, or maybe you're always the one who's left out? Do you have the killer instinct, or have you been accused by others of having the killer instinct? Or on the other hand, do you think of yourself, or have you been called a pushover? Do things just seem to work out for you? Are you just kind of lucky, you know? Or does nothing ever seem to go right? Do you sometimes think there's a conspiracy against you? These ways of describing yourself, even in jest, are often who you really think you are or must be, that is, your cover story. On the contrary, characteristics that you loudly declare are not true of you, as well as qualities that you hide or deny, can point to your undercover. Is there a nickname you're still trying to live down? Are there attitudes that you once held that you prefer now to forget? Things like this may point out qualities you think you must never display. In other words, your undercover. If you discover undercover qualities that you really hate, that repel you, take heart. Remember that every quality can be described in many ways, positively and negatively. And bear in mind that you're probably thinking about these qualities from the perspective of a small child whose parents or siblings or friends or teachers disapproved of certain behaviors. You're probably using labels you long ago attached to these traits with little regard to their actual value. Your undercover can also be found in secrets that you keep, maybe still keep, from your parents. What are some truths about you that even today would disappoint, annoy, embarrass, scare, infuriate, or depress your parents? Two clients of mine make this point. Sandy and Georgia are both hiding "I'm sexual" undercovers from their parents. At 30, Sandy is self-sufficient and living on her own, but she refuses to move in with her boyfriend because her parents would disapprove. At 35, Georgia makes her living writing nonfiction magazine articles. She's working on a romance novel, but she keeps it a secret because she's sure that the sexy parts would shock her religious parents. Neither age nor distance limits our reluctance to expose our undercovers to our parents. Every Sunday, when 40-year-old Max's mother calls, he lies and says that he made his bed and he's going to church, confirming his good and religious son cover. And at 85, Dr. Benjamin Spock, the famous baby doctor, could still recall the terrified and trembling anticipation with which he awaited his mother's reaction to the publication of his book, Baby and Child Care, in which he exposed his ungrateful son undercover by criticizing her child-rearing practices. Dr. Spock was 45 years old at the time that this happened. So, do you have any idea what your undercover is? That is, qualities which are true of you, but which for some reason, a good reason always, you had to hide? Our undercover qualities. Our qualities, which for one reason or another we thought were going to get us into trouble when we were young. But there is nothing wrong with them. So, if Dr. Spock couldn't bear his mother knowing that in some ways he disapproved of her, he could never have written that book, and we would never have had that important information. So what are you hiding from yourself in the world that maybe we could benefit from? Okay. I'm going to stop talking now because the interview that I'm playing today is long, and I don't have much more time to talk, and it's really quite wonderful. I interviewed Eva Slane, who at 80 years old is a patron of the arts in Sarasota, Florida, where I live. Last night, I attended an event at which 28 people were celebrated as the most important people to the arts in Sarasota. This is no small thing. Sarasota prides itself on being the arts capital of Florida, and there are, dare I say, dozens, hundreds of people who are actively involved in celebrating, caring for, patroning the arts here. So to be one of the 28 most influential, most important, this is a big deal. This was a celebration, a launch party for the Sarasota Magazine, a prestigious publication here. So this is a lifetime that this woman has spent working in and supporting the theater. It's an extraordinary view from what is, of course, an advanced age. There is much to be learned from Eva Slane. And if you listen, you can hear it. So here now is Eva Slane. So here I am with Eva Slane in her gorgeous house, which she cleaned up just for me.
Actually, my cleaning girl comes tomorrow.
Oh, my God.
I straightened it. I did not clean it.
Well, I can't
see.
There's a difference. Right, I can't see. It's very straight. It's gorgeous.
Thank you.
So I'm just going to tell you what I tell everybody. I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist. And I interview people who made their living or their life with art. And I know this is true for you. So, and I always ask them the same question. How did this happen for you? How did you find it? How did it get you?
Well,
how did...
I guess I was born into it, actually.
Born into it?
Yeah. I would say so, yes.
Yeah.
My father was an opera singer.
Mm.
And my mother was an actress.
Mm.
Now, this was in Europe. Mm. Very different. But that is kind of my background, and I think probably what I really wanted and never pursued because I didn't have the voice, I think I wanted to sing. Oh. But I never did that, so then acting was sort of second best. And I very quickly got into the business end of things. I was with a... In the days when Off-Broadway first started, when Circle in the Square first started, etc., I was with a group of actors and a director called Current Stages. Mm-hmm. And we were a group of actors, and everybody had to do everything. And suddenly, I was at the business end of it.
Okay, now, you're in... Obviously, you're in New York City now.
I was in New York, yes.
Right. About how old?
Yeah,
were
well,
you?
I was born in Germany, actually, because my father was working in Germany. My parents are Austrian, and in 1933, we had to leave Germany because my father was with the state opera house, something we don't really know here. And when Hitler came to power, the first thing he did is he dissolved all the contracts with Jews. And so overnight my father was out and went back to Vienna. So I emigrated in 1939 f- from Vienna to New York, and then lived in New York for a long time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now you're in New York. About how old are you?
I arrived when I was 10.
Ah, oh, so 10. You mean your whole family moved?
My mother and my father. Actually, my father was here. My father was with a small opera company on a six-month tour, which Sol Hurok put together. Wow. Sol Hurok at that time was not Sol Hurok. He was starting out, too. Mm-hmm. Everybody was starting out. And the tour was very successful. It was over, and Hitler marched into Austria. So the whole company, instead of going back to Vienna, went first to Paris, and then they went to Cuba, because the Cuban quota was a better quota. And half the company got into the United States, and then the Cuban quota was cut off. And so half the company is sitting in Cuba, half the company is here. Hurok had contracts for everybody, and the people that got in came in on work permits, work visas, which were never fulfilled. So my father was always a little fearful that he might be deported,
right.
But that never happened. And the first thing he did is he got papers for my mother and me, and we were like on the last boat that came out directly to New York. Then there were the boats that went from port to port,
trying to find a place.
Land any place.
Right.
Hitler marched into Czechoslovakia while we were in the Atlantic coming over. So we were very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Vienna during Kristallnacht.
Oh my.
But, you know, I was a child, and I have vague memories of it. Not of the night, but the day after, walking in the street and
seeing everything.
My paternal grandparents had a business in the Jewish section. And my mother's father and I went there the next day and saw the broken glass, and the stores were all boarded up. And I do remember that.
Yeah.
But I wasn't directly affected.
Right.
I was very lucky.
Extremely lucky. Yeah, yeah.
So
you grew up in New York, essentially?
Basically, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes. I went to school in New York. I went to Hunter College.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents and I got out, and very, very few of the family really wound up here, and now there's nobody. There's me.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you went to Hunter. Did you major in?
Well, there was no theater major at that point. We had a club, and Evan Hunter, who has an Italian real name, and he passed away a few years ago. He was in a show. I was in a show with him. He was in a show with me, and at the club, this club, and it was an anti-war play called "Sound of Guns, Babies Crying."
Mm.
I don't have the script anymore. I wish I did, but it was an anti-war play. And then I was interested in acting. Tried to be an actress for a while. And then, you know, there were no accidents. But by accident, I found out that a secretarial position in an agency was going to become available. The wife of Ed Asner, Ed Asner was a client of the office starting out at that point. She was the secretary, and they felt a little uncomfortable about her being in the office. He was a client. And I was at a birthday party sitting next to her, and she mentioned that she would be leaving, and I said, well, if you do, I'd love to get an interview. I did. I got the job, and a year later, I had my equity agent's license.
Wow.
And I became an equity agent.
Wow.
Which I loved. That was an important part of my life.
So what you did was you helped to make life better for actors.
I hope so.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I really feel that every performer gets their own jobs. You can open doors for them. You can get them auditions. Beyond that, it's up to them.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of performers think that the agents get them jobs. Well, not really. Not really.
Well, they get them entree.
They get them
entree. And without that.
And then they've got to be, to know their craft, to have put all that work in. Mm-hmm. They have to be the right type, which they have no control over.
Right.
And they have to have luck, you know. Being talented isn't the only thing.
No.
It isn't. Also, they have, I think, to be easy to get along with. Because when it comes right down to it, if somebody's going to be trouble, no matter how talented they are, one tends to stay away from them.
Yeah.
It's not worth it.
And that gets around.
Yeah.
So did you have to deal with that a lot? I mean, people who were not...
Not directly, no. No, I wouldn't say so. But my husband had a theater. My husband was a producer. And I know from his point of view...
Yes.
...that he would not hire somebody who he felt would be a problem. He would just get a good actor instead of a brilliant actor.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I'm actually... it's kind of interesting because I have a perspective both from the producer, from the actor, and there's something to be said for each side.
Yeah,
and you
yeah.
need to understand it. So.
Yeah, and I'm imagining that it made you valuable to the actors who you represented because you could speak for what...
I was in a very interesting office. It was a small office. my boss... was Lucy Kroll, who was really my inspiration and my... I learned a lot from her. And it was a very small office. But we had very important clients. We had people like Helen Hayes, Lillian Gish, Uta Hagen. Oh, I'm dropping names.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, if you're going right. to... If you have those names to drop, that's...
Yeah.
I mean, that's that is the cream of the crop.
I did bring James Earl Jones into the office, but then as he got to be... more successful, he became Lucy's client, of course.
Ah.
And we also, we were a literary agency as well. We represented Horton Foote.
Oh, my.
Carl Sandburg, and then after he died, the estate of Carl Sandburg. Wow. And, you know, it was a very prestigious
yeah,
office.
No kidding.
So I was very fortunate. And Lucy really operated... more as a manager than an agent. We never took manager's commissions. We always stuck with the 10% agent's commission. But we really did a lot for our clients, which was very nice.
Yes.
Yeah. It was very satisfying.
Yeah, and it also made you desirable. So how long did you do this?
I was with Lucy for 7 years, and... then I was with a commercials agency setting up an equity department and getting them the equity license for 2 years. So I was an agent for 7 years, for nine years. And then moved to Massachusetts where my husband's theater was. Well, that's a story too. He started it in 1954, way before I knew him. And built it from scratch. It was a theater in the round. It started with 1,000 seats and then got up to almost 1,800 seats. We retired in 1983. When I left New York, we kept the New York apartment, but our home then was in Massachusetts. Then I worked at the theater in various capacities.
Whatever they needed.
Yeah, whatever they needed. I started in publicity, which I did not care for at all, which is kind of funny because that's kind of what I was doing for the West Coast Black Theater Troupe on an unofficial, not an unofficial, but it, It was a donation.
I was just going to say, unpaid.
It was not a paid. Right. But I did that for years. And here it was okay, because here I knew everybody. Mm-hmm. But when I started there, I really didn't know the Boston area. I didn't know. Right. I found that very unsatisfying. What I loved was working on subscriptions. When I started, we had like 600 subscriptions. When I left, it was over 9,000. So it was good. I knew everybody. But I did other things too. We had a crafts gallery. My husband and I did all the shopping and inventory. And
I bet that was fun.
But we retired in '83, so a long time ago. And the theater this year was 53 years old, and it was one of the first big theaters to close.
Oh dear!
And it went on the auction block. The bank took it off. Well, they had a $10.5 million debt.
My goodness.
And, you know, just couldn't get out of that. There was a fire 3 years ago, and they weren't fully insured. They thought they were, but they weren't. Had to take a big loan, another big loan. And they owed other money, too. October 1st, it went on the auction block, and it went for $3.6 million to the bank. What the bank is going to do with it, who knows? We were hoping that some theater organization or some college, I thought it would be great if a college took it over, mm-hmm. and it became
a workspace, art department center,
you know.
Right.
It could still happen if the bank leases it to a theater, mm-hmm. but that is so unlikely to happen.
But it must be very valuable property.
Yes, it is. But, you know, at this point in our economy, I don't know if they will even find somebody who wants to take the buildings down and put condos up or an office center or something like that. I don't know. Money is so tight at the moment.
Right.
I don't know what the future is for that. But it's in the past, and, you know, I kind of let it go.
But it's a loss.
It is. It is a loss. Yeah, and it's a big loss for that community.
Yeah, I'm sure. So how long did you live in Massachusetts, and then when did you?
Well, we moved our main home to Massachusetts in 1966-67. I was commuting in the summer. My husband was commuting in the winter, and it got too difficult. And then we moved down here in 91, but we retired in 83 and got involved with a place called Kripalu, which is a center for yoga and health. And you're smiling.
I know about
Kripalu.
I do.
Well, Kripalu had just opened the facility in Massachusetts in Lenox. And we were there the first weekend as guests. And then the next 14 years, we spent about half our time at Kripalu as part of the spiritual community there.
Wow.
And that was another part. You know, you look back on your life and you see this phase and that phase. And that was an important... And it sort of stopped our looking around to move. We kept our home on the east coast of Massachusetts, but spent about half our time away. And then that continued after we moved here. Continued until 97.
You mean that you went back?
That we spent, once we moved in here, we still spent 3 to 5, 6 months at Kripalu. Mm-hmm. But then my husband had an accident. He was sideswiped by a car, crashed to the ground. It was just before his 82nd birthday. He was considerably older than me. And he was severely brain damaged.
Oh my God.
And lived for a year and a half in a nursing home, and then I had him home for 3 years before he died.
Oh my God,
so, yeah.
And when was that?
97, and he died in 2002.
It's not that long ago.
No. No.
My God.
Well, he's gone 7 years now. So.
Yeah, I know. I know it seems, I don't know, it's both, it seems both long and not.
Yeah, exactly. Know? Exactly.
So,
you know, I feel I lost him twice. Once,
yes.
After the accident.
You know, my dad died of...
I mean, he was a different person.
Yeah, my dad died of Alzheimer's. And I felt exactly the same.
So you know.
You know. Yeah, I do know.
The only difference is one was sudden and the Alzheimer's is a...
Right, that's right. But you lose them long before you lose them.
Absolutely.
Right. And I don't know what your experience of it was, but for me, it wasn't until he actually died that I realized how long ago I had lost him.
Mm-hmm. No, I knew when it happened that the man I was married
right.
to was gone.
Right.
For a month he didn't talk at all. Then when he started talking, he talked a blue streak, except you couldn't understand one word he said.
Oh my God.
He was completely aphasic. And then slowly, slowly, some of it came back. And, you know, from where he was much better. But you couldn't have a real conversation with him.
Right.
You know, it was very difficult. But I took him to theater, and we took a couple of trips together.
Just the two of you?
Yeah. Yeah. I was very courageous.
You were.
I was very courageous.
You were. Oh, my God.
Think about it now.
Right. Oh, my God.
I went to New York for my 50th college reunion
mm-hmm.
and took him with me. And that was one of the trips.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed at a hotel. And one morning, I was in the bathtub, and I had left him in bed, and I hear him rummaging around, and he comes to the bathroom door, and he says, "I'm going," and he's wearing his pajamas, he's wearing a raincoat over them, he's wearing a cap, and slippers, and he says he's going downstairs. And I said, wait for me. I'll be right with you, and we'll go and we'll have breakfast. Well, he was gone. So, you know, I got out of the tub, got dried off frantically, quickly, threw some clothes on and went downstairs, and he was nope. And I said to him, go to the restaurant and wait for me there.
Right.
I went to the restaurant. No, they hadn't seen him. I went to through the lobby, looked every place. And then I went to the entrance of the hotel, and New York, it's very busy. There were cabs around and people, and finally the doorman paid attention to me, and at first he said he hadn't seen them. Then he said, oh, yeah, he thinks he did see someone like what I'm describing. He got into a cab, and he said, LaGuardia.
Oy, oy.
And now, I kept thinking he couldn't have said LaGuardia. He couldn't get that word out, and why would he say that? So the doorman said to go to the security. So I went to security, and that guy was on the phone for the longest time and eventually hung up. And I told him, and he called the police right away and reported his being gone. And then we waited just a little bit, and he got a phone call back. They had found him. The police had him. He was in a... car rental place right next door. And I think what must have happened, he probably did get into the cab. And the cab driver immediately realized
that this was not,
this
okay,
was not
right.
okay.
Right, and told him to leave.
And no, let him out.
Yeah.
And then he walked, and this man at this parking place saw him. And took him in, and I think he called the police.
Right, good for him.
So, but, oh, that was something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had visions of his going to
LaGuardia and wandering around. We're going to find him there.
So that was pretty scary. But we managed.
Yes. Yeah, you survived it all.
Yeah.
So now I have you in Sarasota.
Yes.
And I know that you're in everything. Well, so how did all that...
That actually happened after his accident. Mm-hmm. I remember... How did it actually, truly start? Well, the first board I was on was Theater Works. 3 months after that, it went by the wayside. You know, they folded. And, of course, I thought I brought them bad luck, right? And because of Theater Works, I got to know Nate Jacobs. And then Nate formed his West Coast Black Theater Troupe.
Right.
And I got on that board right at the beginning. So that's, I guess, how it kind of happened. And I was their publicity director for a long, long time. 2 years ago, I went off the board and onto the advisory board.
So we stopped because the phone rang.
The phone rang.
Right. And I think we were talking about West Coast Black Theater Troupe. But that's not the only place that you are active.
No. I don't know, then it just sort of progressed. Currently, I am on the advisory board of West Coast Black Theater Troupe. I'm on the board of directors of the Oslo Repertory, and I am very involved with the conservatory, and I started sponsoring a student when my husband was in the nursing home, and I have kept that up, and it's a joy to be able to do that. I really...
What does it require?
It requires donating some money for their stipend.
Right.
And I get very involved with the stuff they do. I really seem to know most of the students quite well, not just the students.
Yours, not just yours. Right?
Not just mine, yes. Mm-hmm. So I do that, and I'm on the board of the Manatee Players, and the Manatee Players are building a wonderful new theater. The building is up. It, however, is not equipped yet. Mm-hmm. No sound system, no lighting system, no seats. It still needs about $4 million.
I was just going to say they need fundraising.
$4 million more. And anybody that is interested in getting we're still calling it a hard hat tour, you no longer need a hard hat because the building is very safe and complete, the outside of it and some of the inside. Anybody that's interested, we love to show it off. Mm-hmm. And so if you want a tour, just
Is there a telephone number in case... People, local, anybody who has the...
There is, but I don't have it in my head.
Well, all right, but give it to me, and I'll add it.
Great, yeah, great. Janine Witham is the person to talk to.
Great.
She will be delighted. And actually, I have arranged a good number of tours and taken people from Sarasota to Bradenton, because, of course, we Sarasotans think of Bradenton as a foreign country.
God, yes. It's true. When you said the Manatee Players, I thought, my God, that's so far away.
Well, it isn't.
No, it isn't. No.
From where I live, it takes me maybe 25 minutes. I also go to the Venice Theater. It's no longer the Venice Little Theater. It's Venice Theater.
Oh, I thought
they changed the name.
I didn't know.
It's no longer Little. It has grown up. And for 3 years, I was on their play selection board, which I enjoyed very much.
So, you've really stretched on either side of Sarasota here.
Yeah.
That's great.
And then I'm involved with some other things, the Women's Resource Center and... various other. I keep very busy.
My God, yes.
Keep very busy.
Yeah, even just the stuff that you've mentioned is it sounds like a full-time job. No?
Yes, it is.
I'll bet it is.
It really is.
I'll bet it is.
Yeah. And keeping everything kind of straight. And then, of course, I'm also involved with the CUNY Alumni Social Organization.
Yes.
And actually, that is taking quite a bit of time because guess who puts the programs together?
Oh, I can't imagine.
Yes. So now I've got the program for our annual luncheon in February. I've got that all scheduled to set. For our holiday party. Mm-hmm. That's kind of fun.
It's wonderful, and you know, I'm listening to you and I'm watching you talk about it, and it feels like a good life.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It is. You know, it's an amazing feeling to kind of take stock of all you have done through your life and to realize you've done something.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Because as you're doing it, you don't have that feeling at all.
No, you know? Get lost in it.
Yeah.
You get lost in it. No, I think it's, well, clearly you have done more than something. You've done many somethings, you know?
Well, thank you.
No, so I like to ask, if you just take a second to think of what it's been like, if there's anything that you want to say about spending a life as steeped in the arts, in all of the arts, really, as you have?
Well, you know, it's interesting you put it that way. I've never felt that I was steeped in the art. My passion is theater, and I've devoted my life to it, but not in an artistic way. So actually, in the last few years, I've done a little bit. I've done a little bit of writing. Very, very little. Very little. But the satisfaction I've gotten from it has been quite strong. I got, now how many years ago would this be? Like 6 years or five, 6 years ago. I got a letter from the Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg. An invitation to come to a meeting, which I did. And the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. did a program of getting Holocaust survivors together, and it's a writing project. And they started writing, and they put out a book. And this program has now been copied by a number of other Holocaust museums, including the one in St. Petersburg. Well, I didn't realize what I was going to. I probably would have said, oh, I don't have time for this, and wouldn't have gone. There were 17 of us who started out, and for a year and a half, we met every month. And in between, we did some writing, and then we brought it in, and we read it, and we critiqued it. Two reporters from the St. Petersburg Times met with us. They didn't tell us how to write, but they kind of described their own process. We started with 17 people and wound up with 7. It was very hard for some people to do. I did it, well, first of all, I didn't know it would be this long and this involved. I did it basically because I don't have much memory of my childhood, of the years in Europe. And I thought perhaps by trying to write, now we didn't have to write specifically about that, we could write about anything. And we put out a book, it's called We Were There, Memories of the Holocaust. And we were all different. I told you before how fortunate I was that I got out in time. I was not in hiding. I was not in a camp. I got out. But my extended family did not.
Right.
And it does there is a certain amount of who and what I am that is part of that experience.
No kidding.
Anyway, we did this book. We had one book signing where all seven of us were there. That was in the museum in St. Petersburg. And then here we've had, I think it was four mm-hmm. book signings. And they went very well. And I did a 10-minute, one of the things that I wrote about, I first did a 1-minute play. You know, we have the
Got a Minute.
Mm-hmm. That was the first thing. Then I extended that to a 10-minute play and did that for the Odyssey 10-minute play competition, I guess it was. And I won second prize. I won $150. I won some money.
Oh, my God.
It was great. So I've done a little bit of writing. And every year for the GAM, for the Got a Minute, I have written a 1-minute play. So I've written 4 1-minute plays, and I've written 2 10-minute plays. But the last one I did, Odyssey did not take it. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was good, however.
Mm-hmm.
And what I told, the story I told you about being in New York with my husband and he disappearing.
Yeah.
Disappearing. That's what that one is about.
Wow.
So that's a 10-minute play. And then I changed that to a 1-minute play, and I didn't think that was particularly effective. I was not thrilled with it, but we did it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I'll ever have enough time to do some more writing, but I do have a couple of ideas about what I want to write.
I'm sure you do.
I just don't have the time. There's just not enough time.
No, for people who fill up their lives with interesting things, there really isn't enough time.
No.
You know? And I think it's really exciting that you're writing. Have you not thought of doing a little acting?
Well, it's funny. There's going to be a play at the Players Theater here, and it's going to be done in their new theater, which is a black box.
The black
theater,
box.
The black box theater, and it is about the Holocaust. And I auditioned.
Wow.
And I did a good audition.
Wow.
And I was going to get a second audition, but I was away. I went to Massachusetts, to Kripalu.
Mm-hmm.
My husband is buried at Kripalu. I'm going to be buried at Kripalu.
Wow.
And I like to keep some kind of
contact
with them. I have not been spending the kind of time that I used to, but I try to go at least once a year there. So I was there when they have the
callbacks.
The callbacks, and so I was out of it. But I did an audition. I learned a.
Like an audition piece?
Yeah. And I remembered it. I memorized it. And I got through it, so I'm very proud of that.
I am so impressed. I mean, what courage that must have been.
Well, I thought I was crazy to do it, to tell you the truth. And then I told a couple of people that I was going to audition, and I told them because I felt if I said it, I would
was
going
to
have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what I did is I used something of the 1-minute play that I had written, and I made a monologue. And I really need to... the person that did the part, it was not a monologue in the play, so mm-hmm. it was a little bit easier. But it was so difficult to remember. It was I wrote it in such a difficult way, and I was not aware of
that. Well, that'll teach you. That'll teach the playwright.
Absolutely. I have to apologize, you know, because I did not realize how difficult it was.
That's great.
So I don't know the next time I write whether I'm going to do it as difficult or not. I have a way of writing which kind of, it's interesting. I didn't really realize it until I learned this monologue.
Mm-hmm.
When I learned this monologue, I realized what I do, and I kind of repeat things except a little differently. A little differently.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't repeat it just the right way,
it doesn't
lead to the next thing.
Right. So if you get confused, you've lost yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
So, anyway.
Well, but you see, what I hear is I'm just going to use the word again. I mean, the tremendous courage, you know, because you don't have to take any risks in your life now. You just don't.
But I believe that is the thing to do.
Obviously you do. And not only do you believe it, but you live it.
Yeah.
That's glorious.
And I think, you know, at this point, I'm old enough that it doesn't matter, you know?
Well, I my guess is that you wouldn't find a lot of 82-year-old people saying that. No, I think it's true.
80.
80. Oh, 80. Pardon me. 80. I don't want to rush you. Right. It's old enough. But you wouldn't find... What you find instead is people who can't get the energy up to take those risks or who think, what would... You know, why do I have to do that now, or what's the point, and stuff like that.
I know where you got the 82 from.
From your husband.
From my husband.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I remembered after I said it, right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
That's all right.
I didn't
That's
mean to
right.
rush you.
That's all right.
But 80 is plenty.
I guess.
And you don't find, I mean, what you find, you know, forgive me, this is a bias, but what you mostly find is people, you know, playing cards and playing golf and, you know.
Well, I don't do that.
No. And, you know, I'm not disparaging that.
No, it's
I'm just
not.
Saying
it's
that that's
fine.
The stuff they know and that's the stuff they do, but they're not pushing the envelope particularly.
Yeah.
And you clearly are, and it's lovely. You know, I...
Thank you.
The Lynn Show is about becoming who you are, learning who you are and becoming it. And, you know, as a therapist, I know that most people are not actually who they are. They're who they were told they had to be or what they thought they had to do or stuff like that. Very few people are.
I was told years ago, I'm a Capricorn.
Mm.
I was told years ago that Capricorns are late bloomers.
Yeah.
And I guess that's true.
Well, you are a beautiful bloom. and it's an honor to talk to you, and you make the point that I try to make in the show, which is that human beings really can be who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, you can mine everything that there is in you. It's not necessarily easy. It's not even always safe, but it is possible, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Well, it certainly has been for me.
Thank you.
So there you have it, Eva Sladen, at 80, still discovering who she is, still uncovering parts of herself that are vital, important, significant, useful, from which the world can benefit, parts of herself that for reasons that have to do with probably the horrible early experiences of her life, she was not able to uncover until now. But it is never too late. So I hope that you are benefiting from hearing Eva and her story, benefiting in the way that you can look at your own life and ask yourself, what is it that I haven't done that I always wanted to do? Who is it that I haven't been that I always wanted to be? It's very, very likely that that person is already you, that that quality is already yours. of course, as always, I'm running out of time. It's so sad. But I can't end the show without thanking the intrepid Josh Hackney, who comes here and makes sure that the sound of this show is as good as it can be. And I'm afraid that the sound at the beginning was a little soft because I'm having a little vocal trouble today. But I know Josh has fixed it as much as it is possible to be fixed. And that if you have any IT needs, you know, computer, electronic, recording, pretty much any of that, you want Josh Hackney. Oh my goodness, I haven't given any way to get in touch with me, or for that matter, Josh. So you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com. That's THELYNNE. Don't leave out the E, SHOW, thelynnshow.com. You can email me. You can listen to the old shows. You can get in touch with Josh. And actually, if you want to get in touch with Eva, you can do it the same way by getting going up on my website and emailing me and asking me anything you want. So, as always, I am hoping that you got something you can use from this show. I'm pretty sure that if you listened to Eva, you got something you can use. But in any case, something that interested you or compelled you or amused you or even annoyed you, if it promises to bring you back. Because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And boy, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten